Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A recent report is proposing ways to build enthusiasm among young voters for getting them engaged in the political process. Researchers say it's more important than ever that they do so. We'll have more on that just a little bit later. But first, Israel's Consul General for the Midwest has been visiting St. Louis from Chicago for a series of meetings with civic, religious, and political leaders here. He's here to talk up economic opportunities for his country and ours, and to answer questions about Israel's stance on the major issues confronting it. I spoke with Roy Gilad in our studio yesterday, and he began by explaining his role in this country.
From my office in Chicago, I cover 11 states. The way that Israel is represented in the United States is that we have one embassy in Washington, which is in charge of the federal relationship. On top, we have 9 offices all over the United States, which are in charge of the relationship on the state level. And I got the biggest number of states, 11 states, actually all the Midwest except Ohio. And surely Missouri is one of them. And when you speak about Missouri, you speak about St. Louis. So I go between those 11 states day in and day out. And this is already my second visit to St. Louis since my arrival to Chicago a year ago.
Well, you have a very busy schedule here. You're meeting with any number of people and a wide variety of them, from the Archbishop to African-American leaders to political leaders to academicians. What is the mission for such a visit?
My business is very simple. I'm there to build bridges, to build a bridge between – the bridge is already there. I'm there to make it stronger and wider, a bridge between the state – between the Midwest and the state of Israel, between Missouri and the state of Israel, and between St. Louis and the state of Israel. One important visit that I had that you didn't mention was to the Washington University – to the School of Business. They have very close relationship with Israel, and we are going to do some other stuff. Actually, wherever you go around in St. Louis, actually the relationship already there. I just visited the Danforth Plant Science Center. They also have relationship with Israel. So actually, I have to be modest. The bridge is already there. It's my responsibility to make this bridge wider and bigger.
Wider and bigger to what degree and to what sense? Would that be to generate business between this part of the country and your country?
Business is definitely very high on the agenda. We do also political stuff. I'm going to meet the mayor. I'm going to meet the lieutenant governor. In the future, I'd like also to go to Jefferson City to meet the governor. And we try to make, when we come for a visit, we meet usually also local senators and congressmen, in order to make the policy of Israel more understood. We can speak about it later on in the interview. Academic relationship are very high on our agenda. Reach out to different communities, like the meeting I had yesterday with the African American community, Latino community, Catholic. So again, when you speak about bridges, this bridge has so many dimensions.
You come here at a time when there seems to be, at least it's reported this way, something of a strain between in relations between your country and the United States, given what's going on in Syria, what's going on with regard to Iran. I'm sure this is part of your discussions.
Indeed. That's very high on my agenda. The relationship between Israel and the United States are being defined as special relationship, as strategic relationship. And this goes way back since our establishment 65 years ago as a state. Actually, the president that should be accredited for starting this strategic alliance is Lyndon Johnson. It started with late President Kennedy, but Lyndon Johnson was the one that really gave it a push. And since then, the relationship are only improving. Now, it's true that every now and then you have what we call in a diplomatic language hiccups. We had it in the past. We are having maybe another hiccup now, and we'll have it in the future. But it's important to take some distance, like perspective, and say, hey, the relationship are there. They are strong. They are becoming stronger and stronger under President Barack Obama. I think there is a huge improvement in the strategic alliance between Israel and the United States on different dimensions, security, military, intelligence. And obviously, there are some issues, some challenges that we have a different view. You mentioned the Iranian challenge. I think the major difference concerning the Iranian challenge is a tactical one. On the strategic end game, we are exactly on the same page. But going back to your question, it's important to realize that the relationship between Israel and the United States of America are solid rock, and this is not going to change.
And yet we continue to read, and tell me if what I'm reading is wrong, is that our president and your prime minister, Netanyahu, Mr. Netanyahu, don't get along, that they really, there's some severe friction between the two.
So I don't know. I mean, I read the media just the way you are. Unfortunately, I'm not on the line when the two are speaking, and they speak very often, by the way. I don't think there are any other two leaders that speak so often over the phone. So, but you know what? For the sake of the argument, let's say that you're correct and there is some personal tension, which I really don't know if there is. But for the sake of the argument, I say that strategic relationship like the one between the U.S. and Israel are go much beyond personal relationship. Good personal relationship can contribute. President Clinton had excellent personal relationship with late Prime Minister Rabin. And the relationship was, the strategic relationship were excellent. The relationship between President Carter and late Prime Minister Begin were not excellent. And yet, the strategic relationship were very good. So, personal relationship can contribute, but at the end of the day, this is not the most important dimension of this strategic relationship. Strategic relationship usually lean on interests. And I think nowadays, facing everything that is happening in the Middle East, the common interest is only wider and bigger.
As is often said, it's a very tough neighborhood that you come from.
Indeed, to say the least.
To say the least. Let's go back to the Iran Accord, if you will. You say that your government and ours have the same ultimate objective. But what is the basic difference?
I think this can be compared to a football game. Your football game. If a team, if an offense plays 10 yards from the end zone, that's very dangerous. Especially we know that the Iranian offense has an intention to get to make a touchdown, a nuclear touchdown. So we believe they need to be pushed back. Now, we understand that they are entitled for nuclear energy. That's fine with us. What we say, their nuclear energy should lack two elements that have the capacity of dual use, that can be used for nuclear energy, but at the same time to produce a nuclear bomb. And I'm talking about enrichment of uranium and plutonium. So if we eliminate those two elements from their nuclear energy program, this is what I mean by pushing them back to be at the center of the field. We don't like when they play on the nuclear field. We think this is wrong. But if they are adamant of playing on the nuclear energy field while having so huge quantities of oil and natural gas in Iran, so one can ask himself, why do they want a nuclear energy? But if they are so adamant of having it, let them have it without enrichment of uranium and without plutonium. And this is, I think, one major difference between us and the United States. For the Iranians, enrichment of uranium became an issue of national pride. For us, enrichment of uranium by the Iran is a matter of national security, national survival. And I think we come to the United States and say, look, you have to decide whether national pride is more important or national security is more important. We say national security should come first.
I think no one's going to argue or dispute that tough neighborhood, and having a neighbor who was armed with nuclear weapons would certainly be a problem. But I'm sure you're being asked as you travel around the Midwest and your area, those states that you mentioned, that people are saying, well, it's an open secret that Israel has a nuclear weapon. Why shouldn't its neighbors be just as concerned as you are?
Indeed, I come across this question quite often. Look, the fact that you say that this is an open secret means that nobody actually knows for sure what Israel has or has not. And anyway, there is no room for comparison whatsoever between the responsible leadership of Israel that is really being challenged by all our neighbors. And the leadership of Iran, that since its establishment as a Muslim state in 1979, everything that they did in the Middle East was only to establish instability, whether in Syria or in Lebanon or in Iraq, you name it. And this was done as a conventional superpower. But if there will be a non-conventional, sorry, regional power, but if there will be a non-conventional, a nuclear regional superpower, the damage that they did till now as being a conventional strong state will be very limited to the damage that they can make coming from a nuclear state. So I think this will serve the interest of everybody, the West, Israel, the moderate Sunni world, to make sure that Iran will be limited with their intentions.
But isn't it easy to understand why they might be just as suspicious of one day things changing in your country, that you would be a nuclear threat to them?
They have no reason whatsoever to be concerned. Israel said many times that we shall not be the first one to introduce nuclear weapon into the Middle East. If indeed Israel has some capacity in this field, this is for defense target to defend ourselves. I attended once a presentation of Shimon Peres, who used to be our prime minister. He is current the president, and he, according to foreign sources, he was in a way responsible also to the development of this option, if indeed we have it. And he said that something which is interesting. He said Dimona, that's the site presumably Israel has something, is there not to bring, God forbid, for Hiroshima, but to bring into Oslo. This was at the days of the Oslo Accord. So the idea is to make sure that Israel is a strong entity that is not going to go anywhere, and make sure that the Arabs will understand, which already two states understood by now, that Israel is an entity that is there to stay. And indeed, Egypt signed a peace accord with us, Jordan signed a peace accord with us, and we hope that all the Arab states and even the Muslim state in the Middle East, I'm talking about Iran, in the future, they will sign a peace accord with us.
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I just want to make the point that sometimes words are just words, regardless of who says them, and that things can change.
Things are not going to change in Israel. Israel is a state who is seeking peace, who is seeking stability. We just signed the beginning of the week. Not many of your listeners know, but we signed an agreement in Washington. Our minister of water, the Jordanian minister of water, and the Palestinian minister of water, an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, of digging a canal between the Red Sea, next to Eilat and Aqaba, and the Dead Sea. And this canal will produce desalinated water for Jordan. For Jordan is having a huge lack of water. And the leftover of the water will go all the way down to the Dead Sea to try to because the Dead Sea is losing a lot of water, and in short time it's going to be completely dead. So the idea is to elevate the water of the Dead Sea. So I'm just bringing it to Don as an example that things can be done, even under the current circumstances. As for Iran, I really think there needs to be a change in Iran, and I think Iran needs to be part of the region. It's not so much about being a great friend of Israel, but Iran alienates itself also from the region. You can ask Arab states along the Gulf, they call it the Persian Gulf or the Arab Gulf, they are much more terrified than Iran than us. We can protect ourselves, but not all the states in the Middle East can protect themselves.
Well, all we can do is wait and see. If the whole issue of sanctions and the opportunity to examine the nuclear facilities there produce something to depress the concerns.
Is our interest. Sure. I'd like you to make it clear to your listeners. We support a diplomatic solution. For any other solution, we will be the first to pay the price, for we are on the firing line. We are for a diplomatic solution as long as this is a solution and not just another deal.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Israel's Consul General to the Midwest, Roy Gilad. How about Syria? Another neighbor that is going through what some consider perhaps even death throes today. Israel's position with regard to Syria, what's taking place and how to resolve it?
Look, from a humanitarian point of view, what is happening in Syria is a disaster. And, you know, you're talking about more than 100,000 people that got killed, were killed, assassinated during the last couple of years. That's a terrible tragedy. However, we say that we do not intervene in what's happening in Syria. That's a domestic issue. The two sides are going to go to Geneva in the beginning of middle of January in what is known as Geneva 2. We hope they will sort out their differences. Our interest is to make sure that the situation, the instability in Syria will not spill to our border. And I must say that indeed, the Israeli-Syrian border along the Golan Heights that was so peaceful for so many years, is not peaceful anymore. Israeli patrols have been attacked or ambushed on the Israeli side of the border. There was fire that was launched from the Syrian side of the border. This is one dimension that concerns us. Another dimension is the relationship between Syria and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is very much involved in the war in Syria. They help the Syrians. Actually, in a certain stage, they even saved the regime. And at the same time, the regime pays them off by sending them more sophisticated, more advanced weapons than they did in the past. And this is another source of concern to us. So as long as this instability and chaos is taking place in Syria, we are not happy because we know that's a humanitarian tragedy, but we do not intervene. We don't have a dog in this fight, like you like to say here. But if this conflict is going to spill over the border and endanger our security, Israel is not going to stand still. Let me just say one more thing. Since the beginning of the conflict in Syria, we have admitted to Israel dozens, maybe even hundreds of people that were injured. We have deployed a field hospital along the border. So some of those people are being treated at the field hospital in the Golan Heights. Other cases, which are more severe, we take them to hospitals back in Israel, either in Nahariya or in Sfat. We treat them. We send them back. Nobody pays us. But that's our small contribution to try to solve the humanitarian crisis in Syria.
But it's nothing like what's going on in Turkey or even Jordan in terms
of
refugees.
Course. I think you have hundreds of thousands of refugees in Turkey or in Jordan, but surely you don't expect that under the current circumstances we shall open our borders. Mm-hmm. But we try to do to the best of our ability. And again, deploying the field hospital by the army along the border, it's not an easy thing. And admitting tens, dozens of Syrian soldiers, whether they are from the opposition or the government, we really don't mind. Once the Syrians bring to the border a soldier that was injured badly, we don't ask questions. We take him to the Israeli hospital. We operate it. And once he's better, we send him back to the border.
Another component of this whole situation with Syria that hasn't been mentioned is the introduction of chemical weapons into the process. I mean, this has got to be certainly disquieting to your country.
So we were following very closely, Don, the agreement that was signed between the United States, Russia, and Syria. And I think there are two lessons which are important for us in this context. First of all, this agreement was signed against a transparent military threat, American military threat against Syria. For only a few weeks before the agreement was signed, Syria even denied that they have chemical weapons. So what made them sign this agreement with the U.S. and Russia? I think what made them sign the agreement is the understanding that if they will not do so, they will basically be a target of an American limited military strike. For there were five American carriers along the border, along the seashore of Syria. And Bashar al-Assad, the president, understood that unless he signs this agreement, this might be the end of his regime. So the first lesson that we have is that indeed sometimes diplomatic options or diplomatic solutions can be assisted by a military threat. That's the first lesson. The second one goes to the depth and accuracy of the verification process, the monitoring process. So currently they tell us the dismantling of the Syrian chemical capacity is going okay, and the monitors are saying that basically things are going the right way. On the other end, another state that went through the same process, Libya in 2005, also we were told that everything is okay. And once the opposition got control of the state after Muammar Gaddafi was gone, we discovered that this was not exactly the case. We discovered, not we, but the international community discovered missiles with chemical warheads after presumably Libya didn't have the capacity anymore. So that's the second lesson. Monitoring, verification is important, but limited. Not always it can really discover all the picture.
One of the things, again, that we're reading here, and I'm sure you're here, you're reading it as well, is that Assad is winning this civil war and that he may very well remain in power. What happens if, in fact, that is the case?
Look, we are following the events in Syria very closely, and I don't know if he's winning. I don't think we are going to see the same Syria after this is over. And really, from a humanitarian point of view, I wish it will be over very soon. But this is not going to be the same Syria anymore. I would like to think, this might be wishful thinking, but I would like to think that the relationship between the new Syria and Iran on one end and Hezbollah on the other end will not be as strong as it was in the past. For Syria was really the strategic link between Iran and Hezbollah. And Syria was bad news, not only for Israel, for the region. That's why Turkey has a position that they think Assad should go down. Saudi Arabia think Assad should go down. Qatar thinks Assad should go down. We don't think, we don't have a dog in this fight. But the Sunni states, they think that the current regime needs to go down. And the main reason is the strategic alliance between the Syrian administration and Iran on Hezbollah on the other end, which you call the Shiite axis or the Shiite crescent. So whatever will happen in Syria in the future, I really wish that the people in Syria will have a future which will be much better than the miserable life they had in the past.
You do have a dog in the fight with regard to the Palestinians.
Indeed.
Two-state possibilities there. Where does that stand right now, and what is our role in that?
Well, your role is second to none. You know, currently, as we speak here now, Don, Israeli and the Palestinian representatives are negotiating again, not in the first time, in Ramallah and in Jerusalem. And let's hope, for the benefit of both people, that they will be more successful now than we've been in 2000 and 2008. And I don't want to be judgmental and say whose fault was it in the past. We are trying to open a new chapter, a new page. And look, we basically believe that the two nation state solution is there also to serve Palestinian interest, but we are here to represent Israeli interest. And we believe that the two nation state solution will eventually serve Israeli interest by guarantee our future as being both a state which is Jewish and democratic. That's the only solution that we know to guarantee this future for us, which is so important. However, I think we still are facing huge challenges. The Americans might be in a position that they will put some draft on the table. I don't think anybody expect a final status solution within 5 months, because you know, Don, this framework of talks were defined as for 9 months by the Americans. I don't know why 9 months. Maybe they spoke about pregnancy, they thought about pregnancy. But not much of the time is left. We have still 4.5 months to go. The chances for us, Don, to reach a final status agreement, I think, is quite slim. But I think with some creativity and American determination, we might reach a long interim agreement that will, and again, one of the problems is that the Palestinians are divided. We are speaking now with the coalition that is in with the West Bank. But what about the other coalition in Gaza? What about the huge number of refugees that are sitting outside of the West Bank and Gaza? So indeed, I think the challenge is huge. If indeed we can reach a long interim agreement that will last for 10, 15 years and will be a bridge to the final status agreement, I think we should be very happy.
And the settlement question is part of this. How does that stand?
Settlement question is definitely one of it. One of the, you know, we are talking about five portfolios of the final status agreement. We are talking about settlements. We are talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about refugees, borders, and security. Now, all the five are very complicated. And I know people always like to ask about the settlements. At the end of the game, the settlement has a solution as well. I think it was said already. It goes back to what is known as Clinton parameters from 2000 at Camp David. It's quite understood that Israel will have to pull back from most of the West Bank. But at the same time, there are some what we call realities on the ground. There are three big blocks of Jewish settlements, Jewish communities in the West Bank that most probably there is no way that Israel can pull back from those areas. In return, I believe that Israel would be willing to give some kind of swap of lands. The ratio still needs to be discussed. Unlike what some people think, the settlement is not the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge, if you ask me, is the question, whom does the Palestinian Authority represent? Are they only representing the 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank? Or are they representing also the 1.5 million Palestinians who live in Gaza? Or do they represent the 3 to 4 million Palestinian refugees who live in Jordan, in Egypt, in Syria, in Lebanon? For if we sign a deal only with the West Bank, this is one thing. But we would like to reach a deal that will be the end of claims. This is our aim, and I'm not sure that we are there.
You're on a limited time clock, I know. I have one more question I'd like to ask. We didn't even get to Egypt, which I think we should have talked about, but let's save that for another day. Well, what I'm interested in hearing from you is, what do you think it is primarily that Americans don't understand about Israel and what Israel goes through?
That's a serious question. First of all, for me, as being an Israeli diplomat in so many places, it's the first time that I crossed the Atlantic and represent my state in the United States. Basically, in the Midwest, I think we enjoy, I would say, a basic wide understanding for the challenges that Israel is facing. And yet, one of the things that I'm doing here is to try to shed more light, not on the challenges that we are facing. And because the challenges, basically, I think the average American citizens, he knows much about it, but to the economic miracle that Israel is. Because under those very challenging circumstances, of which we just spoke on for the last 20, 25 minutes, Israel managed to maintain a very strong, solid economy, which is really can be understood either by a miracle, a divine miracle, or by other things that has to do with the Israeli stamina, with the Israeli DNA, if you want. And we are very proud of that. So I would say this is my biggest challenge in the Midwest, to make sure that Israel will, that people here will connect Israel not only with the challenges that we have, as we know, we're not short of, but with the achievements of the State of Israel for the last 65 years. For Israel really is a good brand name.
Thanks to Israeli Consul General Roy Gilad. Coming up, getting young people engaged in the political process, they've got a long way to go. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.